Hello, I'm here with Patricia Noonan, or as you told me to call you last time, MP, who is the creator and host of the podcast, Who Killed Heng Ngor? How's it going over there in New York?
It's good, it's good. It's getting on towards fall.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I was there last September, sweaty. I didn't think it could be such a sweaty city.
No, it's very warm. You're surrounded by brick.
All right. Well, anyway, I'm a huge fan of your show, and it's just come back after, I don't know, a fairly long hiatus, and we've got season two, and new episodes are dropping weekly. Now, we spoke briefly about a week ago just to get to know each other a bit, but I really wanted to have you on to talk about your podcast because it tackles this case in a way that reminds me of that first season of Serial, you know, the cultural phenomenon that basically kicked off the whole modern podcast scene about 10 years ago. And while I'm not usually a fan of sort of wanky phrases like this, I kind of want to signal boost what you're doing. It's a show that's quite different to my own, but you're out there doing an on-the-ground investigation of what I guess you would call a cold case. But I think if people who listen to In the Shadows of Utopia are interested in Cambodian history, and I know many of them have seen the film The Killing Fields, then they should absolutely go and subscribe to Who Killed Heng Ngor right now. The link is in the description below. But before we get into the show itself, why don't you just give me a little, and the listeners, a little sense of your own history with Cambodia. How did you get involved with this country?
Well, first, I just want to say thanks so much for having me on. Also, I love the comparison to Serial. I'm not sure I would go that far describing myself, but I love the comparison. It's very flattering. I was a foreign correspondent, so I left university and went straight to Asia, and I taught English for a year in Thailand. And then when that was wrapping up, I realized I didn't want to come home yet. I still wanted to be doing something different. And at the time, Cambodia was in the news every day in those Thai newspapers, you know, the Bangkok Post and The Nation, because there was a UN peacekeeping mission there. And so I thought I'd go check it out. I had sneaking suspicions that I want to be a journalist. Bought a plane ticket, and with a plane ticket out again for 10 days later, and I ended up staying about 14 months in my first trip there.
So what's this, like 1993, 94,
that was, 95? I showed up in Cambodia of October of 1992.
92, wow. That's amazing. Some people, I mean, a lot of expats that I run into here, they kind of look back on those years very fondly. And sometimes I wish I was born like 10 years earlier. And then other times I think, no, I probably wouldn't have done very well to be here amongst all of that chaos. But what was your impression of the country like back then? That was a pretty wild time.
It was a phenomenally interesting time, and it was very much a time warp. It was very much like walking back into the 1970s, because Cambodia had been so isolated for so long. It really was. I mean, the only places I can really think of now are like Cuba and probably North Korea. You know, you really are stepping back into a different decade. And also, as an American, we all grow up kind of with the mythology of Vietnam. So we've all seen, you know, Apocalypse Now and Full Metal Jacket and Platoon and all these shows. So it really is like walking into a page of history for us.
Yeah, yeah, man. And, well, I guess it's pertinent to ask, had you seen The Killing Fields before you went?
I had seen it, but I definitely got more into seeing it again. I remember one time when I was back in the States making friends see it. I don't remember the first time I saw it, although I was certainly aware of it when I went to Cambodia.
All right. Well, speaking of the movie, I wanted to share a little bit of a personal anecdote, but it's one that I think isn't very personal because I think probably hundreds of people will probably have had exactly the same experience as me. So I, you know, during high school, I was about 15. That's when I watched The Killing Fields for the first time in history class. I really liked the film. It was my introduction to Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge. And then I, you know, I started doing my little history essays, and I was a, you know, I was an interested little guy. So, you know, I finished watching it for the third or fourth time, and I went on Wikipedia, and, you know, you're doing some background research and you find out who's who, and you follow the link to Hang Nyor, who played Dith Pran in the film, and his Wikipedia entry, I remember it being quite short, but it informed me quite sadly for the first time that he had in fact died. He'd been murdered in America in some kind of Asian gang related robbery where Hang Nyor had refused to give up a locket that contained a photo of his wife, the only one he still had. And for those that don't know, his wife sadly died during the regime. So it was this horrible but oddly poetic end to this story that I basically just took at face value and hadn't given it much thought that there was a possibility that there was some other version of how his murder took place. Now, if I was to just kind of tee you off with that, tell me about your podcast. Obviously, we want to be avoiding any spoilers and things like that, but what's wrong with that story that I just told? Like, tell me and the listeners what your podcast is trying to do.
I will say, I was still in Cambodia when Hang Nyor was murdered, and I remember hearing about it, and I had some California friends who are more familiar with the area. I'm in New York City. I'm an East Coast girl. And it stuck in my head. It was troubling from the very beginning, and I remember that there was an early report that, like, none of the gang members on trial for the killing spoke English very well. It was almost like they spoke like a gang sort of pidgin patois, and a lot of the witnesses, you could say that would be true, probably more so of the witnesses. So there was all sorts of problems with the trial. At the time, I seem to recall Sam Rainsy, the opposition leader, accusing Hun Sen of being involved in the killing. I did put that question to Sam Rainsy more recently. He does not remember saying that, so it's a little bit my memory versus his memory. But it seemed troubling.
He tends to say a lot of things.
Yeah, it seemed troubling from the beginning. And now that I've gotten into it, it's very troubling. As an American citizen, I'm embarrassed that these kind of trials happen. They really did stitch up three teenagers and throw the book at them.
So you're basically saying that the Wikipedia entry I read when I was 16 was not the full story?
Absolutely not. Wikipedia is probably not. I haven't looked at that in a while. It's probably been
Has been changed in the intervening almost, I don't know, 20 years, but...
it probably has been changed. There's also any number of true crime shows in the States on, you know, basic cable, and they all will reflect upon the tragedy and the irony because two of the gang members were the children of Khmer refugees. The third was a Chinese national. You know, this Cambodian hero would be killed by Cambodians in America as this, you know, bitter, bitter irony. But I obviously don't think that's the case.
Well, before then we get into some of the other theories, I feel like maybe, you know, my little anecdote there maybe doesn't quite, you know, for people that aren't aware, what is the standard story of what happened to Hang Nyor?
The standard story is that he was driving home one night. He'd been at a friend's house, And there are actually photos of this little event at the friend's house. I think it might have been a birthday party. And you can see he was wearing his Rolex watch. And he was known to wear a gold chain with a pendant on it, as you said, it with the image of his late wife who died during the Khmer Rouge years. And so he drove home. It's a very long alley. And he was, he parked. He was approached by gang members who were mugging him. And the police narrative is that he gladly gave away his watch, but then he refused to part with his necklace because it was of such sentimental value. And so he put up a struggle, and for that he was shot. There's a lot of holes in that theory. One of which is that whoever mugged him left his wallet, which had $2,900 in it. It's very troublesome, especially when you see the crime scene. It's not certain that he was even wearing the necklace and pendant that night. What happened was Noor had a niece who he had adopted leaving Cambodia as a refugee, who was 27, 28 when he was killed. And sometime after the murder, the police didn't have any leads, and she approached the police and said, how do I get back his necklace and his pendant? Because it was his family keepsake. And they said, hang on, what necklace and pendant? And out of that, they invented this narrative about a fight having taken place, about it being a botched robbery. But that is entirely an invention of the police, because there were zero witnesses to the crime. That was just a missing watch and a missing, an allegedly missing necklace. And that's the entire premise of the trial that locked up three teenagers.
Wow. So if listeners, if that hasn't sort of, you know, got your ears sort of perked up already, I don't know what will. So again, you've done season one, and we don't want to do too many spoilers, but what are the, you know, sketch out a couple of the big other theories then that you might have investigated so far.
There's a major theory, of course, that the Khmer Rouge came back and killed him. And that's what was very, that was the first conclusion a lot of people leapt to in the Los Angeles community of former refugees who'd resettled there. Heng Noor was active in Cambodia. He was pushing for a human rights tribunal at the time to hold the Khmer Rouge accountable. And there was this notion that Pol Pot had sent assassins to Los Angeles to kill him, or called upon a sympathizer in Los Angeles to kill him. And I go into that very early on in the second season. That theory just doesn't hold water for me. But given the amount of trauma that these people went through, I think it's entirely logical that that was the conclusion a lot of people leapt to.
Yeah, particularly at that time. What year did he die, sorry?
He died February 25th, 1996.
96, right. Yeah, so post-UNTAC and prior to the sort of Hun Sen takeover.
It was post-UNTAC. It was prior to the defection of Yang Sirri, which happened in later 1996, and was really a death knell for the Khmer Rouge. And it was before the coup between Hun Sen and Prince Ranarid. But the Khmer Rouge, I mean, when I was in Cambodia, I spent a lot of time covering hostage crises. There's a significant one in Kampot involving three backpackers, and there's a significant one involving out of Kampong Som involving two expatriates who owned a restaurant and their friend who was visiting. And that's one of the signs of the collapse of any insurgency, is when they turn into a kidnap for ransom gang. There's very little ideology attached there. You know, that was one of the death knells. When I was there, that was between sort of 94 and 95, I was covering hostage crises.
Yeah, I remember. There was definitely a couple of Australians, I feel, that were maybe kidnapped from a train or something like that. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, in the Kampot hostage crisis, there's a Brit, a Frenchman, and an Australian who are backpackers, and they jumped on the train from Phnom Penh to Sihanoukville, which goes through Kampot, and this was dumb. It was not recommended at the time, but because it went through Khmer Rouge territory near Phnom Vor, and they were taken hostage. There was a number of Vietnamese who were just outright slaughtered, and they were held for some months, those three hostages. And unfortunately, they died. And it was, because it was a Brit, a Frenchman, and an Australian, it was almost this perfect storm of, like, diplomatic politics. It became a very large story for all those countries involved. And the other one in Kampong Som, it was, there's an Australian woman named Kelly Wilkinson who was, with her boyfriend was Dominic Chappell. He was a Brit. And they owned a restaurant in Phnom Penh called the Deja Vu. And they had a friend visiting. Her name was Tina Dominey. And because they had a restaurant, they went back and forth on the highway between Kampong Som and Phnom Penh. And they just got held up one day. And we don't know if it was Khmer Rouge or if it was corrupt government soldiers or some kind of bandits. But sadly, they were also murdered. And it was very shortly after they were taken.
Man, it's such an interesting period. And having just been out there personally to, like, Hai Lin and Malai in the last month or so, to see, you know, these former Khmer Rouge strongholds, I don't think people really realize that, you know, they get a sense of, yeah, a civil war continued after the Vietnamese occupation, but people tend to assume that the Khmer Rouge really were just confined to the borders, but there was a significant amount of fighting that got well into the country. But yeah, as you say, by the late 90s, the Khmer Rouge are splintering, falling apart, defecting. Pol Pot will order the assassination of Son Sen, who had run the Sentebal, someone he'd known for half a century. He'd met in Paris. And he ordered his assassination, I believe, in 1997, and shortly after was sort of arrested by his own Khmer Rouge that had basically been fed up with him and the policies and said enough was enough. That was led by Tha Mok, who people will be familiar with from my podcast so far, but so Pol Pot dies April 1998, and you lay out a few of the theories, and one of them sort of has to do with Doik, the former commandant of S-21, because he was a major proponent of this Khmer Rouge assassination theory, wasn't he?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, for those reasons you just mentioned, I mean, it's the Khmer Rouge were collapsing slowly, and they were also just so self-obsessed that this notion that they were going to suddenly kill Hang Noor in Los Angeles 12 years after the movie came out and before a human rights tribunal was really cooking. I mean, it's just so wildly implausible. They were so, so inward-looking. I mean, the Khmer Rouge eventually became, you know, a dozen old men in the jungle and, you know, constantly obsessing with each other. But the police investigation into Noor's murder and this notion that these three teenagers did it didn't satisfy a lot of people. And so in Los Angeles and in general, a lot of people sort of carried on this idea that the Khmer Rouge might have come and killed him. That somehow they were responsible because the actual police investigation was you know, riddled with holes. And then Comrade Doik, who was arrested in, I believe it was 1998, and essentially gave state's evidence against the Khmer Rouge, was the first to testify in the tribunal that eventually came about. And in 2009, I mean, he was witness number one. Mm. And in 2009, he said that Pol Pot killed Hang Noor. And so that reignited this massive conspiracy theory. And people are saying, see that? We're right all the way along. This guy would know. But there's a lot of reasons. The book, The Lost Executioner by Nick Dunlop, explains this very well. But I think Comrade Doik was projecting his own experience, because someone had broken into his house and killed his wife, and he thought it was Pol Pot, and that might be slightly more plausible with him, given that he had kind of left the Khmer Rouge as much as one can. But he's like, well, it happened to me. It must have been that same thing that happened in Los Angeles. But he really stoked the theory again.
Doik's testimony is very, very interesting, because he, first of all, he was the only one that did actually express any sort of guilt and apologize for what happened. And then on the last day of his trial, he tried to basically renege on the whole thing and ask to be set free.
Yeah, he flip-flopped. He flip-flopped pretty bad.
Yeah, his testimony is very, very interesting, because it always shows about one third of the picture. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to visit M13, the prison that he operated as early as 1971 out in Kampong Spu. And he said that, you know, tops, maybe 200 people were killed there, if that. And basically, everyone else that has come to testify on that matter says that that number is at least comparable to those that died at S21. So we're talking in the tens of thousands. So, yeah, Doik is...
If I were there, I'd be tagging along with you.
It's a place that I've had stuck on my places to go list on Google Maps for about 8 years. So finally getting to go there and see this place in person, I am looking forward to this trip tomorrow and seeing this site, which is basically the new memorialization site as part of Chong Ek, Tu Sleng, and M13 out in Am Liang. But so the Doik theory, we can sort of put that to rest. But again, without getting into spoilers, are there any other general sort of directions that you've taken? Because it seems like season two, you really do seem to be like on the ground investigating this. Like, you visit the scene of the crime. Walk me and the audience through that. Like, what is the investigative process look like for you? And has that changed since season one to season two?
You know, it's changed dramatically between season one and season two, because I started looking into this and poking around, and much of season one is very historical. And then I went out to the crime scene and I met with one of the lawyers for the one individual who's still incarcerated for this murder. And he essentially, we clicked. He liked me, and he realized I didn't want to just do a podcast. I would genuinely like to solve this crime. And so he gave me a whole lot of material from, you know, court transcripts. And I've been working with his research consultant from the Innocence Center, who goes by Frank. And we've actually got a very good partnership going on, because me with my, you know, Cambodia field knowledge, and Frank is a retired police officer who worked in, you know, the anti-gang division, and specifically the Asian gang division in Southern California. So he knows that topic very well. And so for me, as someone who sort of started my journalism career in Cambodia in the 90s, what's interesting to me is how much in the 90s I wasn't aware was going on in Cambodia. And so Heng Noor was back, you know, when UNTAC opened the country up, and he had the Heng Noor Foundation, and he had a lot of investments. But there are any number of vulture capitalists, and what I'm now learning are very criminal elements who took root in Cambodia in the 90s. And now we know how many criminal elements are in the country today. So it's really the seeds of the of the problem we're seeing there today with all the organized crime and the scam operations. So I'm trying to pick through Knorr's business associations and some of the plans he had that failed, some of the people he was hanging around with, because some of them look quite dubious. There's another wrinkle, and I think Knorr had terrible PTSD. And I think from a 2025 perspective, it's pretty obvious. But even from a 1990, certainly from a 1980s perspective, people were much less aware of how PTSD can impact your life. And he could be a very abrasive person. He was terrible with money. So that's really what I'm looking at, are the businesses he was trying to deal with and the people he was trying to deal with. It's very difficult because he died at the dawn of the internet. So a lot of records just may not exist anymore. So, I continue to dig, but the wealth of information that the Los Angeles police missed is extraordinary. I mean, to be fair, it's not their job to go to Cambodia and investigate things. These are LA cops. But if you can't make your case, you don't get to ruin the lives of three teenagers.
Yeah. And I think that's what's so fascinating about your show. And, well, I mean, one point of difference between my show and yours is release scheduling, where I might take a couple of months to release an episode that goes for maybe 2 hours. But yours are being released weekly. So while I'm over here doing my research for this trip, if people want, you know, if they want their fix, if they want an ongoing investigation like you're doing, this podcast is riveting. Like you say, it's like you're doing it week by week. You're sort of digging and digging and finding out new things as you go. I get the sense that you don't know where this might end up, but that's where you're trying to get to.
I don't know where this is going to end up. I mean, I have several episodes in the can ready to be released, but I'm still looking for certain interviews. I'm still digging up certain angles and trying to find some smart analysts to speak to who remember the 1990s. The sad thing is also because, you know, if Hang Knorr were alive, he'd be 85. So a lot of his contemporaries are no longer with us. And even a lot of the people in the academic world who are very familiar with some of these issues I'm looking at, like organized crime trends in the 1990s, those people are beginning to fade away as well. So, I mean, I've definitely picked quite the challenge for myself.
Yeah, you really have. And is this like your full-time, like, this is what you're doing at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm freelancing when work comes along, but this is a passion project, and I really feel like I need to get this out. I hope it leads to more work down the road. I like this type of investigatory stuff, but this is my opportunity to tell a little bit of untold history and hopefully solve this case.
Amazing. And like I said, I think everyone that has seen The Killing Fields and knows that story about Hang Knorr's death, to have that sort of challenge in a way that is immediately like, oh, okay, it wasn't that. It's, like I said, it's a completely riveting podcast and way more people need to be paying attention to it. So I hope that my listeners are going to do exactly that. I'm not really on social media anymore. I think we discussed last time that we're both not huge fans of social media generally. But if other people are on social media and want to be sharing your podcast or mine, you can plug my podcast too if you want, if you're out there, if you've got a Twitter account or Instagram or whatever. But yeah, I really do urge people to get into your show. It's coming out week by week. There's a whole first season to get into. There's good history there. History that I've, you know, there would be a couple of little minor points where I might have jumped in and said I would have explained that slightly differently. But again, we have very different approaches and very different purposes in what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, can I throw in one more element before we wrap? Just from the LA point of view for your listeners, you know, Noor died in February 1996. You have to consider that in 1995 there were the LA riots, which involved they were sparked by police beating up an African American man in a traffic stop. Mm. And also in 1995, what was cooking was the O.J. Simpson trial. Mm. So there were a lot of allegations against the Los Angeles Police Department at the time. And then here you have this Oscar-winning actor, this beloved hero of the Cambodian community who gets murdered. Think about the amount of pressure there must have been on the LAPD. Yeah. To arrest somebody, to get this case right. So there was a lot going on. And even in the course of the trial, there was the murder of Tupac Shakur and another rapper whose name was Notorious B.I.G. And so there's all this concerns about this East Coast, West Coast gang war. So there's a lot of global focus on the LAPD at the time.
It's all wrapped up. It's a enigma. It's a what do you say? A riddle wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in the LAPD.
Yeah, and if you really want to get into it, there was a scandal called the Rampart Scandal, and the LAPD were found to have there were corrupt elements in the LAPD that were cooking the books on some trials, and it resulted in something like 100 convictions being overturned, but this particular case in the Noor murder was not examined as part of that review. Hmm. But that's really getting into the weeds.
Well, people that listen to my podcast are very used to being extremely deep in the weeds. So I think they're really going to enjoy your show. And yeah, like I said, people should just get out there and give that first season a listen, because straight away you're going to get hooked.
I appreciate this so much. I mean, there is social media. I have a little Instagram account, and it's Who Killed Hang Noor, but there's underscores between each word. That's on Instagram.
Okay, I'll include that in the podcast description as well.
Yeah, and there's also a YouTube page as well for Who Killed Hang Noor without underscores.
Oh, and your website as well.
Yes, there's whokilledhangnoor.com, and so there's a lot of photography, especially for the first season, and just links to a lot of the material.
Brilliant. All right, well, everyone, get out there, get listening, get subscribing, and MP, I'm listening every week, I'm hooked. And I'm really interested to see where this goes, because it's just a fascinating thing that you're doing.
Thank you, Lucky. I really appreciate the shout out for your listeners.
No, it's my pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure. All right. Well, I'll let you get on with your lunchtime New York. Probably got some kind of sandwich or something waiting for you. Some kind of New York.
Something like that. I'll see what I can dig up.
All right. Okay, well, it was great speaking to you again, MP, and we can stay in touch.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Not a problem. All right, have a good day.
Take care.